She had regained some of her composure. I said, "Now you have to come with me." She nodded. "I know. Once I realized they really were going to kill you, I couldn't just sit back." "Me and my whole family are glad you came to your senses. Now we gotta get out of here."
"But where? Henry knows people all over the city. And I'm not sure if he owns any police. I don't know who we can trust."
I said, "I do." Chapter 79. Christoph panicked for a moment when he snapped out of the pain-induced blackout. His eyes wouldn't focus. He wasn't even certain where he was or what had happened. Then it came back to him in a rush. He didn't think he'd been unconscious for long, but it was still going to take some time to get going. Then the light bulb in the middle of the ceiling above the loading dock came into focus. He blinked a couple of times as he lay on his back, assessing his injuries. His head throbbed like the bass from Smoke on the Water. Then he moved his leg and it hurt so badly he forgot about his head. He rose onto his hands and knees and thought he might be sick. The splash of blood on the floor made him lift his fingers to his face. Blood was still trickling out of his nose, his beautiful, straight nose, which was now broken, badly. It was so flat, it felt like he just had two holes in the middle of his face. He was startled when a new sound ripped through his brain. He was worried he might be having a seizure. Then he realized it was Ollie knocking on the steel loading dock door. Slowly he managed to make it to his feet. He felt his face again and thought, "That son of a bitch really clobbered me." And Natalie had been part of it. The pounding resumed in his head. Christoph stumbled over to the wall where the control for the door was at chest level. He had to lean against the wall and focus just to hit the right button. Then he heard the slow pulse of the motor pulling up the door. The rattle of the steel felt like someone running their fingernails over a chalkboard. As the door rose at its glacial pace, Christoph tried to wipe the blood from his face. Now he noticed his eye was tender. His nose, his eye, his leg. That cop was going to suffer. So was Natalie. He needed his knife. He spotted it on the floor. The door was finally up, and the gray Volkswagen Passat sat puttering beside the loading bay. Ollie shook his head and said,
"What happened to you, brother?"
He tried to hide his shock at the sight of his partner.
"It was a combination of Natalie and that cop. She ambushed me, and he caught me while I was distracted."
Christoph limped over to the knife and scooped it up with no small amount of dizziness. Ollie thought for a moment and said, "If you want to do something to Natalie, it's probably best we leave without talking to Henry. He still pays the bills." Christoph clutched the handle of the Gerber tightly.
"I'm going to use my knife on both of them. Slowly."
"Another reason we should wait to talk to Henry. I say we jump in the car and start looking for them. We'll call Henry and tell him to do some of his computer magic and see if he can find anything. But we don't call him until we're already out of here, just in case he has one of his fits and tells one of the locals to shoot us."
Ollie ran up the short flight of steps next to the loading dock and found a rag on a workbench inside, then used it to clean up Christoph. He wiped his partner's face like a mother cleaning up a three-year-old. Blood sloughed off the rag onto the floor. Ollie said,
"Hopefully people would think the blood on your shirt is a design."
Christoph shoved his knife into its sheath. He was in no mood to listen to his partner. He wanted blood for blood. They had a brief discussion about who was going to drive. Christoph wasn't interested in debate. Finally he said,
"I'm driving,"
and pushed past Ollie. The two Dutchmen got into the car and scanned the sidewalks for Bennett and the girl as they drove. It was early evening and there weren't that many people on the street. Eventually, Ollie pulled out his phone and dialed Henry. He put the phone on speaker in case Christoph wanted to add anything. Henry answered the phone with an impatient,
"What now?"
Ollie started with the touchy subject first.
Your girlfriend attacked Kristoff and helped Bennett escape.
After a long silence, Henry said, Is Natalie still here, or are they both missing?
They both fled.
Are you certain Natalie helped him?
Absolutely. She hit Kristoff with a board and shattered his nose.
Her phone is still here. Too bad. That would have made finding her much easier.
Ollie said, Sorry, Henry.
I'm really disappointed in you two.
Ollie said, So are our families.
Always with the smart answer.
Ollie let the silence hang there for a moment, then said, We'll keep searching and let you know if we find them.
Let me see what I can do on this end. I'll call out some more help since you two morons can't seem to handle anything yourselves. If I hear anything, I'll send you to their location.
Ollie cut off the call. He sounds pissed.
Kristoff said, He always sounds pissed. That's how crazy people sound.
Exactly why I'm not sure we should even waste time looking for Bennett and Natalie.
But, have you lost your mind as well? Look what they did to me.
Ollie thought for a moment. But this is still business. We need profit, not problems.
Then I'll finish this alone.
Wait.
No, I'm serious. This has to get done.
Ollie said, All right, we'll finish this. But then we walk away from Henry. This is getting to be a pain. I don't care how well he pays. You get your revenge, we collect our pay, and head straight back to Amsterdam.
Kristoff smiled. That's all he wanted. A chance for some revenge.
Chapter 80.
Without a soul noticing, Natalie and I had slipped back upstairs in the building to what seemed like an empty ground floor and out the front entrance. Then we ran, trying to stay off the main roads. Neither of us was hurt. Natalie squinted at the street signs, and I remembered that Kristoff had knocked her glasses off.
You can still find your way around town, right? It went without saying that I was a tourist. Most of my travels around this town had been out to St. Laszlo's with Fiore driving, and on the floor in the back of Kristoff and Ollie's car where I couldn't see anything. As we trotted down an alley, I said, Do you have any money? Anything we can use to get a ride?
I have a few euros, that's it.
Well, I don't know if that's going to help us much.
I found the euro coins in my pocket that I told Kristoff about, which I doubted amounted to enough for a cab. When Natalie stood on a street corner looking for an approaching bus, I snapped at her. Keep off the street, they'll be looking for us. Natalie turned and frowned at me.
Sorry, I've never been on the run before. How about cutting me a little slack?
After a few moments, she said,
Where are we running to anyway?
Do you know St. Laszlo's Church?
Yeah, but it's on the other side of the city.
The Alexander Nevsky Cathedral is nicer and a lot closer. I'm not going there for Mass. I know someone at St. Laszlo's who can help us.
Natalie led me through an alley and then over a few blocks where we caught a bus. We transferred after a few minutes. The second bus seemed to stop every two blocks.
Natalie said, I can walk faster than this.
Go ahead. I'll meet you at St. Laszlo's.
I was done with whining. As long as we were moving and on the bus, we were relatively safe. I would gladly ride it all night long. About 40 minutes later, I recognized the neighborhood and soon saw the lighted cupolas of the Orthodox Church. I hoped we weren't too late to catch Father Marty at the office. When I raced into the building, Natalie followed me through the door. Almost immediately, we ran into Father Marty. He smiled and clapped his hands.
You found her. Good for you.
He looked at Natalie and said, I prayed for you, my dear. She mumbled her thanks, and I gave him a quick rundown of what had happened. I left out some of the bloodier details, but he now knew the facts. I ended by asking if he had heard about the shootout near Tartu Monti.
Father Marty said, No, I haven't heard anything about a shootout in Tallinn.
The FBI agent who was chasing me was injured trying to save us.
Oh, dear, and you don't know how Mr. Fiore is doing.
No, Father, I don't.
As soon as I make sure Natalie's safe, I want to check on him. He saved my... I paused for a moment, then came up with... life. Mr. Fiore was quite angry at me after I helped you escape. I told him I followed my heart.
And what did he say to that?
He had another suggestion on showing my love for myself.
The priest smiled.
I hid my own smile as I imagined the exchange. I said,
sorry, Father.
No one needs a diverse experience. It's sometimes nice to hear new phrases. And in his defense, he did appear to be a dedicated law enforcement officer. He absolutely is, and I hope he's safe.
Father Marty said,
I can have a car here in an hour. A man I know can drive you down to Riga in Latvia. I think that's the safest course of action. It will be easy to arrange a flight back to the U.S. from Riga.
Natalie said,
can I send a quick email to my mom? I left my phone back at Henry's building. Of course, my dear. Use my office. There are some drinks in the little refrigerator if you need them.
I plopped down in an overstuffed chair. Suddenly, the events of the last few hours hit me in a wave. I dozed off before I even realized how comfortable I was.
Chapter 81. Christoph was behind the wheel of the Volkswagen Passat. He hated this car. It didn't fit his image. Ali had tried his best to talk his partner out of driving. With blood still leaking out of Christoph's nose and his face turning a dark purple, Ali had thought it would be best if he drove. The debate had lasted almost a minute until Ali had relented. Now, as Christoph's vision blurred, he wasn't about to say anything to his partner. He blinked harder to get a better view of the streets of Tallinn. A woman, walking hand in hand with a little girl on the edge of the street, had to spring out of the way as Christoph swerved. Ali turned quickly to see the woman on the curb holding the girl and cursing them. Christoph thought the vision issues might have more to do with his feelings than a physical injury. He was furious, and his fury was focused on two people. All he could think about was sticking his knife into Bennett's throat. He imagined the blade when it first broke skin and he smiled. He wanted to do it just like he had done it to his cousin all those years ago. He never would admit to anyone how satisfying it had been. She had been laughing and threatening to expose him, and he had put an end to it with a simple, single thrust of his pocket knife. He pictured Bennett in the same situation, grasping his neck as blood pumped out of the severed arteries and veins. This time, Christoph wouldn't panic. Instead, he'd enjoy it. Natalie was another story. He was thinking he wanted to watch her die slowly, maybe by strangling her. He could picture that pretty face staring up at him as he choked the last breath out of her. Her brains wouldn't count for shit when that happened. Natalie had brought this on herself. To Christoph, she was just another of Henry's many girlfriends. Until she'd hit him in the face. Now she was a target. Henry hadn't given him explicit permission to kill Natalie, but as far as Christoph was concerned, it was implied. Henry was hard to figure. He never confided in anyone, but there was no doubt he was a business genius. The operation ran flawlessly, and they raked in a lot of cash. To Henry's credit, he generally wasn't shy about spreading the money around. On the downside, he could lose his temper and order one of his hired thugs to kill anyone at any time. The perfect example was Janos and Alice in New York. They had apparently questioned his authority. Now everyone knew he was the king, even if the king was a little crazy. Christoph had known Henry since the beginning. The computer geek never would admit it, but he had changed. Some people speculated it happened when he got into weightlifting and using steroids. But Christoph had seen his dark, murderous side even before that. The first killing Henry had ordered them to commit was a programmer who'd stolen some of Henry's ideas and applied them to businesses in his native Canada. They had flown first class to Toronto, rented a car, and driven for what seemed like days just to shoot the young man in the head at his parents' house. Now it was absolutely personal for Christoph. He didn't care if Henry even paid them for these killings. They were going to happen. Ollie said, "What happens once we catch them?" Christoph tried not to show his anger in his voice. "We already spent too much time and blood on this. Once we find the cop and the girl, I know exactly what I want to do. We take them to our favorite dumping ground in Copley-Leanid. With all the new construction there, no one will notice a couple of bodies stuck in the foundation of one of the new houses." Ollie was quiet. Finally, he said, "Maybe we let this one go. We could find other jobs." Christoph flared. "No way! Not these two." "Perhaps we should talk to Henry first."
"He's busy. He's got other problems."
Ollie said, "I'm worried about the fat guy who escaped. He has details about us."
"You worry about things too far ahead of time. We need to live for today. And today, we are going to kill Bennett and Natalie."
"That's the kind of shit Janos used to say. Look where it got him and Alice. I like looking into the future. I enjoy life too much to waste it. The fat guy could give the police everything. Maybe we'd be better off to end this and head back to Amsterdam right now."
Before Christoph could rebut his partner's logic, Ollie's phone rang. It was Henry. Ollie put it on speaker. Henry's agitated voice was scratchy on the tiny phone speaker. He said, "Looks like Natalie accessed her email on a Wi-Fi network." Ollie asked, "Do you know where the network is physically located?"
"St. Laszlo's Church."
Christoph said,
"Damn. We followed him there yesterday. He must be friends with the priest. We'll call you when we're done."
He ended the phone call before Henry could say anything else, just in case their fearless leader had second thoughts about his girlfriend. Chapter 82. I came awake suddenly when a hand gently shook me. Father Marty and Natalie were standing over me, smiling. The giant chair still felt like a wide, soft pillow, and the remnants of a dream stuck in my head. I was marrying Mary Catherine. My grandfather was officiating, and Brian was with us. Pretty nice dream. But now it was back to a rougher reality. Father Marty said,
"It's impressive you can fall asleep so quickly."
"How long was I out?"
"About an hour.
Your car is out front. Natalie told her mother she's safe, and my colleagues in Lafayette are expecting you." I said, "Thanks. Sorry we're tying up one of your people." Father Marty waved me off. Lackey was driving to Riga anyway. He's our IT manager for the entire region. The Orthodox priest smiled. "It's an old church with new ways. We find that social media keeps us up to date on what people are worried about." A red Volkswagen sedan sat in front of the church. The young man standing next to it smiled and introduced himself. He was tall and a little awkward, with thick glasses and shaggy hair. He couldn't look Natalie in the eye. He looked like an IT character in a TV show, only a lot taller. A box of files sat on the front passenger seat. Natalie and I slid into the comfortable back seat. We made our goodbyes, and our driver waved to Father Marty. He looked over his shoulder and said in accented English,
"Make sure of seat belts. We're going on some bigger roads. If police check, the fine is unbelievable."
Natalie said,
"You make this drive often?"
He hesitated. It looked like he was screwing up his courage. It must have worked as he turned and looked directly at Natalie.
"Once every 2 weeks. How do you say in English, semi-weekly?
I had to think about that one for a moment. I was pretty sure he was looking for bi-weekly. I wanted to get moving. I needed to know Natalie was safe, and then I needed to check on Bill Fiore. The longer we waited, the more anxious I felt. As I sat there thinking about it for a moment, I saw a flash in the corner of my eye. Another car was barreling directly toward us.
It had hopped a curb and was cutting across the stretch of park across the street from the church like a missile. The crash was tremendous. It was as if sound faded away, then my whole world spun in every crazy direction. Our car flew across the sidewalk, spinning 180 degrees before plowing into the bushes in front of the church. The driver's soda, which I learned that moment was called Lumi Val Gekka, floated into the air and seemed to freeze in space as gravity worked its magic on everything else. It felt as if the laws of time had been suspended. Everything happened in slow motion, until it didn't. The engine creaked and shifted under the crumpled hood as the car came to a stop. The windshield crackled, then tumbled into the car, a spider-webbed mass of glass. Our driver was moving. Slowly, he called out,
"Are you injured?"
I was relieved. If he was asking, it meant he wasn't too badly hurt. I turned to Natalie. She wasn't moving, and her eyes were shut. I thought the worst. I gently touched her arm. When her eyes popped open, I almost fainted with relief. I leaned in close and spoke clearly. "Are you okay?" She just sat there for a moment, then she turned her head to face me. Her voice was weak.
"I'm okay, I think."
Then I looked past Natalie out the window. I could see that Father Marty had leapt out of the way. The other car was also a Volkswagen, a slightly smaller one. The front end was smashed. The car would never run again. It rested partially on the street and partially on the sidewalk. Then I saw the other driver. The Dutch killer Christoff glared out of the driver's side window directly at me. This collision was no accident, and it left no doubt what Henry wanted done with me and Natalie. I tried my door, jammed shut. I fumbled with my seatbelt, finally managing to open the buckle. I hit the door with my shoulder. Still, nothing. No one emerged from the other car either. Chapter 83. I'd been in car accidents before. Shock was one of my immediate concerns. Shock did crazy things to people. They couldn't think clearly, and their perception was faulty. That was the last thing I needed right now. I had to do something. My door was jammed, but if we waited much longer, that would be the least of our problems. The interior of our car started to fill with a foul smell. I'm not a mechanic, but it had to mean that the engine was leaking oil or some other kind of fluid. Either way, I knew we couldn't stay in the car. Lotke moaned, then coughed, but kept moving. He pulled the handle on his door and almost fell out into the bushes. One of the hinges on his door snapped, and the door fell onto the torn-up grass almost on top of him. I reached across and unhooked Natalie's seatbelt. She opened her door easily, got out, then turned and reached back to make sure I got out of the car as well. She may have been scared, but she wasn't clueless. I appreciated that. I stepped out on shaky legs. Natalie grabbed me under the arm and helped me stand. I turned to her and said, "Go with Father Marty, right now." It was as if saying his name made him appear. He kneeled down and quickly checked Lockie, who waved him off. Father Marty said, "You both need to run. I'll see if I can delay those men." From what I'd told him earlier, he figured out who was in the other car. I said, "We'll run, but you can't confront these men. They're not like us. They won't listen to reason. They don't care about your standing in the church or if this is holy ground. You and Lotke need to get out of here, too." Father Marty nodded, then shoved me toward the church to get me moving. My ankle and knee felt like someone had hit them with a hammer. But I followed Natalie as she urged me along, just as Father Marty and Lotke trotted roughly off in the opposite direction, away from the church and hopefully to safety. Each step was agony. I knew I wasn't in shock because I rationally considered what a torn meniscus or damaged ankle might mean in the long run. I didn't want Chrissy pushing me in a wheelchair before she graduated from Harvard. Then I had an idea and was able to pick up the pace a little bit. I didn't have a gun, and I didn't have backup, so I had to use our only advantage. I'd been here before and knew the terrain. These two Dutchmen had gotten in a surprise blow, but I knew not to underestimate them. With my new burst of energy, Natalie was having a hard time keeping up with me now as we raced through the church and past the altar. I had a little difficulty remembering the exact path to the hidden corridor Father Marty had shown me earlier that day, but after some turns and a couple of fruitless shoves against the wall, I found the right panel. I shoved it hard, and the entryway to the hidden corridor opened. When Natalie hesitated, I pulled her into the tight passage. There was no time to be subtle. We hustled down the narrow hallway, as dark as it had been the last time I'd traversed it. My knees started to scream at me again. I had a hop limp in my run now, but it wasn't much farther. I could hear Natalie taking deep breaths. The stress and accident had taken a lot out of both of us. I hoped it was having the same effect on the men chasing us. Natalie said, "I hate enclosed spaces. I'm having a hard time catching my breath." "You and me both, but we can't stop now." We finally came to the long sequence of steps that I knew would lead us to the bottom of the hill. The stairway was even darker here, and Natalie hesitated. I didn't have time to argue as I gently pulled her along. I held her hand the entire descent. Finally, we were at the base of the stairs. I burst through the last door into the darkness of the Estonian night. Standing by the open door, I froze when I heard something. The Dutch killers were in the corridor and still chasing us. Chapter 84. Christoph sprawled in the smashed Volkswagen for a few more moments. All he heard were the sounds of metal creaking and something sizzling on the hot engine block. He could feel his toes and his fingers and move his head. He called it a win. When he'd driven along the street leading to the church and seen Bennett and Natalie getting into the car by the curb, something inside him had snapped. He'd wanted, no, needed, to see them dead. He'd never experienced this feeling. Not naked, premeditated, murderous urges. He and Ollie were slow to move. He saw Natalie and Bennett struggle out of the other car. He tried his door, but it was jammed shut. There was nothing he could do. Christoph screamed in frustration and slammed his shoulder against the door. Finally, it started to give. Ollie stood next to him. Then he seemed to snap into alertness. His first words were, "Are you insane? You could have killed us." Christoph's eyes were fixed on Bennett. "Get moving. They'll escape if we don't get to them now." As soon as Christoph stepped onto the sidewalk, his legs gave way for a moment. He had to steady himself on the car. On the other side of the vehicle, Ollie managed to stand up, and he took a moment to check himself. He said, "My ribs are cracked. It hurts like a son of a bitch. Satisfied?" Christoph had almost tuned him out completely. He marched toward the priest, now trying to move quickly away from the church with the young man. Ollie caught up to Christoph and put a hand on his shoulder. He had to wheeze for a moment because he was having difficulty breathing. "I'm not about to threaten a priest," he said. "We know they're in the church. We'll figure out where they went." With some effort, Ollie managed to turn him toward the front door of the church. Inside, without any pews to look under, they were quickly able to tell that no one was inside the nave. Ollie, walking slowly because of his injuries, said, "Back here and toward the offices." Christoph followed his partner down a long hallway. Ollie mumbled, "This place is built on a hill. I bet there's a way to get downstairs and out the back." Christoph grumbled and pulled out his knife. He didn't want to be surprised by this cop again. Chapter 85. There was almost no light at the bottom of the hill behind the church. I was startled when I looked straight up and saw the night filled with stars. It wasn't easy to see any constellations in New York. On the other hand, I would know where to get help in New York, help I could trust. We were outside, but not safe. When we reached a narrow road, we broke into a jog. I kept looking over my shoulder at the church sitting up on the hill. I didn't know what to expect. Someone shooting at us from the top or someone chasing us along the road. We had to walk back up two flights of concrete stairs built into the hillside to get to the main streets of the surrounding neighborhood. This was our best chance to disappear. Natalie said, I recognize the area. We're in Sikupili. Is that good or bad? I just know where we are. There's a lake and a park just over there. There should be some thick bushes somewhere we can hide. I liked the way she was thinking. At the top of the stairs, I didn't see a park. I didn't see much of anything except a few houses. There was almost no traffic at this time of night. I hurried Natalie along, desperately looking for the park or any place else we could hide. I was ready to hunker down for the night and see if we couldn't find some help in the light of day. Then Natalie pointed. Over there, Paya Park, and look, Paya Yarv. She was excited now. I said, what does Yarv mean?
It means lake. There's a big lake in the park. See that bridge? If we cross it, there should be plenty of places to hide.
I studied the bridge for a moment. It was about 25 feet off the water and built for pedestrian traffic. We'd come this far. It was as good a plan as any. It took longer than I'd thought to reach the bridge. Natalie didn't look tired, but she was scared. I was too. We rested for a moment, looking across the bridge. Was there another way out of the park or across the lake? I didn't want to get stranded with our only way out blocked by a killer. Then I heard a gunshot, and a bullet pinged off the rail of the bridge. A second later, I heard the report from the pistol. This time I didn't need to prod Natalie to move. She sprinted across the bridge with me following her. Another shot rang out behind us. About halfway across the bridge, near a red support beam, we paused. I'll admit I needed to catch my breath. But I also wanted to see if both of the killers were chasing us. We might have a chance to overpower one of them. I looked back down the length of the bridge, and standing a few feet in was the Dutchman I had escaped from, Christoph. Even in the faint light from the neighboring streets, I could see him clearly enough. He stood there like some kind of specter with a pistol in his right hand, dangling by his side, and what I thought might be that Gerber knife in his left. He no longer looked like an underwear model, all neat and groomed. Now he looked like a crazy person. His shirt was covered in dried blood, hair whipped out in every direction, and I thought I could see bruises covering his face. He just stood there staring at us. If he was trying to look creepy, it worked. In an attempt to stall, I yelled to him, Impressive! You found us! The tall Dutchman called out,
A child could see where the church's basement should be.
Many old buildings here in Tallinn have elaborate back exits. If I surrender, will you let the girl go free?
I didn't like the smile that crept over the tall Dutchman's face. He raised his right arm and aimed the pistol. There was nowhere to hide on the bridge. If we started running, he'd have a clear shot at our backs. I looked over the railing into the water. This part of the lake was more of a canal with a slight current. It was a longer drop than I'd prefer, but I would have preferred no one was shooting at us. A bullet struck the giant support beam a few feet from us. I felt the shot through the handrail. I heard Natalie gasp. I turned her to face me and said, Can you swim?
What?
I raised my voice like it was going to help. Can you swim?
Yes, I mean...
I didn't have time to hear any explanations. I took Natalie by the arms and said quickly,
Don't look back this way, no matter what happens.
Then I threw her off the side of the bridge. Chapter 86. On the bridge, I had my doubts. If we got out of this, I knew I'd have a lot of explaining to do to Natalie. I hadn't had time to go into the fact that I was afraid we were too isolated for anyone to hear the shots. Christoph had lost all reason, was just intent on killing us, and I hadn't had any other choice but to throw her into the lake. I looked over the side of the bridge and felt a little twinge of vertigo, but I had to focus. I had to think. That might be the only advantage I had over Christoph. His brains had to be scrambled. The problem was that the only thing I could think about was my family. Maybe it was because I was reconciling the fact that I was about to be confronted by an angry man with both a gun and a knife, and I was absolutely defenseless. That gave me an instant flash of all my children's faces. I could see Mary Catherine, Maeve, and even my crusty old grandfather. I shook my head to clear my thoughts. I needed to buy time for Natalie to get away. I heard her shout something from the water, but I didn't look over the railing again. Now I was focused solely on Christoph, and he appeared to be concentrating completely on me. Not only did I want to stall, I also needed to get nearer to Christoph. My only chance was to engage him up close, preferably after he ran out of bullets and somehow lost the knife. Sometimes you don't get to choose the exact time and place of a fight. I held up my hands and started to walk toward him very slowly. I called out, "Okay, I'll come with you." I kept walking, desperately praying that Christoph wouldn't just raise his right arm and shoot me. As I got closer, I could tell he was confused. Natalie screamed something from the water. Christoph casually looked over the railing, raised the pistol, and fired three times into the dark water. There was no way he could clearly see where she was, but I was scared by the fact that she'd stopped screaming. I picked up my pace with my arms still in the air. The thought of that girl being shot by this jerk infuriated me. I'd like to say that I had been counting his shots. The best I could think was he had fired six times, but I couldn't be sure exactly how many rounds his pistol held. If it was a single-stack 9mm, he'd be down to, at best, two shots now. At worst, five. When I was within 20 steps of Christoph, I made up my mind. This was going to be a fight. I didn't care if I ended up with five bullets in me. I was going to stop this asshole. Ollie shouted from a field near the approach to the bridge. Christoph answered him in Dutch. I didn't follow it exactly. Then I saw Ollie sprint toward the banks of the lake. Christoph had told him to get Natalie. Ollie's gait was off. It almost looked like he was skipping the way he moved, favoring his left side. He'd been injured somehow. Probably the car crash. That was information I might be able to use later. I continued to march slowly toward Christoph. I wanted his attention on me and not Natalie. I came to a stop with my hand still raised. We were only 5 feet apart. Chapter 87. Christoph was still trying to understand the anger he was feeling. He didn't just want these two dead. He wanted to do it himself, up close. Everything was boiling over now, and instead of fighting it, Christoph embraced it. Maybe this was what he should have been doing all along, going wild instead of trying to suppress his instincts. His thoughts of rage beat through his brain like a drum. If Henry complained about anything they did tonight, he might have to go too. Henry wasn't so dangerous on his own. He had to hire muscle. Christoph and Ollie were muscle. Without them, he was defenseless. Sure, Henry was trending toward being a psycho. He liked to think of himself as a crime lord, some kind of drug kingpin. But the fault in his reasoning had to do with surrounding himself with nerds. A true kingpin has to be tough on his own. You never know when someone will try to rise up through the ranks and snatch the throne. In Henry's case, there was no one to threaten his power. The computer people he hired wanted nothing to do with violence. Most of them wanted very little to do with other people. That gave Henry a false sense of superiority and security. But Henry could wait until later. Now Christoph had to deal with Natalie and this infuriating cop. Bennett had tossed the girl from the bridge into the lake. Christoph admired that kind of thinking, doing the unexpected, taking risks. That's what Christoph and Ollie needed to do more. He'd sent Ollie down to the bank to grab the girl. That meant he could keep his attention trained on Bennett. Bennett had his hands raised and was walking toward him slowly. Christoph didn't trust him. But this was falling in line with his own plan. He wanted to see the cop up close. Preferably, he'd use his knife. Instead of one jab to the throat, he'd take a few practice slashes, then take an ear or cut off his nose. Maybe make it last a little while. Then move on to cutting off something more delicate. He knew Ollie would argue against that. He just wanted to take both of them to the area in Copley Leaned with all the new houses. A lot of concrete was poured every day. There was always some place convenient to leave a body or evidence they never wanted found. Having two people walk to the site would be much easier than carrying their bodies, and it would leave less blood everywhere they went. Christoph hated cleaning blood out of the car, and he'd done it more than most people. All that ran through his brain as Bennett kept walking toward him slowly, his hands clearly empty and up over his head. He didn't blame the cop for surrendering. The guy had been through a lot. Maybe he'd realized there was nowhere else to run. At least, not in Estonia. Christoph was about to warn him to freeze in place when the cop came to a stop on his own. Now, they were only about a meter and a half apart. Chapter 88. As we faced each other on the bridge, Christoph stared me down, then gave me a little grin. I had seen it before. He was showing me he was in charge. He had won. I have no idea why these idiots think something is over before it's even started. I glanced over the side of the bridge into the lake. I heard, or thought I could still hear, Natalie, but I really couldn't see anything in the darkness of the lake. I tried to gauge where the slovenly hitman Ollie was on the bank, but I had to deal with the younger, fit, armed killer right in front of me. The first thing out of Christoph's mouth surprised me. He said, "Why did you throw the girl off the bridge? She's so light I thought she could fly." Right now I was willing to say anything to buy a few more seconds for Natalie to escape. The problem was I had no idea where she or the other killer were. It had been quiet for too long. I needed to do something, fast. I also wanted to make Christoph scream. I was hoping that might bring his partner away from the lake and back to the bridge. It was a lot of speculation on my part. I kept watching the Dutchman. He seemed pretty confident. Natalie's blow across his face and my full-body block hadn't seemed to slow him down too much. Sure, his nose still leaked a little blood. It was clearly broken and almost flat against his face, but that wasn't affecting his reflexes. At least not that I could see. Then I realized he was waiting, just like me. He was waiting to hear Ollie call up and say he'd caught the girl. That wasn't going to fly with me. I'd taken all the abuse I wanted to take. Christoph finally turned his head and looked toward the bank, hoping to see his partner. His gun was still in front of him, pointed right at my stomach, and the knife was gripped at the ready by his hip. It wasn't a long look, but it was enough. I made my move. The situation was almost identical to what they put us in during training with the NYPD. It's tough. A gun is extended toward you, the shooter's reaction is slower than the captive's action, and you have no other choice. Though there was the added complication of that knife. My hands and feet moved at almost the same time. My hands came down, one arm swinging, to knock the knife out of his left hand almost too easily, just as I stepped forward and closed the distance. My other arm swung toward Christoph's gun hand a fraction of a second later. Then, the gun went off. Chapter 89. I heard the roar of the gun as soon as my body had cleared the path of Christoph's pistol. It echoed along the dark banks of the lake. The heat from the blast penetrated my shirt, That's how close it was. The smell of gunpowder crowded my nose. The bullet missed me on its way to God knew where. As soon as he fired, the slide from the pistol automatically rocked back from the gases in the cartridge. It sliced the top of my left hand, which was holding Christoph's wrist. That kept the slide from slamming forward again. While the gun was useless, I used my right hand, which was closer to the pistol, to reach down and press the magazine release. I didn't know the make of the pistol, but there are two main methods for dropping a pistol magazine. Thank God the button for the magazine was near the trigger. The other way would be on the butt of the pistol itself. My index finger found the button, and I heard the satisfying click, followed by the thunk of the magazine bouncing off the bridge and dropping into the water below. The fight was a little more even now. I liked the way the Dutchman just gawked for a moment when I popped out the gun's magazine. I guess no one had ever fought back against him. Or, like most people, he had seen just a tad too much TV. That wasn't a move people saw very often. Honestly, I'd never done it before. But I wasn't about to fight fairly. Christoph stepped back and stared at his useless gun. I took the opportunity to throw a knee into his thigh. As he grunted and took another step back, I got a chance to throw a big punch at his face. He surprised me by blocking it with his left arm. There was fight left in him, and he was still pretty fast. But I was able to also grab his right wrist and rip the pistol from his hand. The force drove us apart. When I turned, Christoph was standing with both hands balled into fists. He smirked. "The gun's empty. What good is it going to do you now?" It was a good question. I decided to demonstrate rather than explain. I flipped the pistol so I was holding it by the barrel, then swung it like a bludgeon. I kept swinging the pistol in wide arcs. Most of the blows bounced off his forearms, but I could feel the butt of the pistol dig into skin and bones. He yelped as each blow landed. Then I threw a new wrinkle into the pattern. I kicked out with my left leg. I didn't expect it to do much, just catch his attention, which it did. As soon as he shifted and looked down at my leg, I swung hard with my right arm, the pistol still in my hand, like the head of a hammer. I caught him hard, across the chin. His head snapped back and blood sprayed out from his split lips. I stepped back to give him room to fall. Instead, the tall Dutchman stood on wobbly legs. It was like a point of pride for him to remain upright. He was gasping for breath, and every time he breathed out, blood spewed from his mouth. When he didn't drop to the ground immediately, I recognized I didn't have time to wait for his show. The fight had pushed him back almost to the end of the bridge, only 4 feet away. I quickly glanced over the side and saw that the muddy shore was underneath us. I couldn't see or hear Natalie or the other killer. I couldn't wait any longer. I tossed the pistol far into the lake. Then I grabbed Christoph in a bear hug. I lifted the tall Dutchman off his feet and tossed him over the side of the bridge. It was a lot harder than when I threw Natalie over. I knew he'd missed the water. That was the point. Chapter 90. I raced off the bridge and scrambled down to the banks of Paya Lake. Christoph had landed almost exactly like I needed him to. He was stuck in the mud up to his shoulders. His left arm was pinned under him in the dark muck that surrounded the lake. Just his head and right arm had escaped the gooey prison. He looked like an alien from a cheap science fiction movie. But he was conscious and appeared to be unharmed. He looked at me and screamed, "Get me out of here!" The disembodied head turning frantically to see how close the water was. I wondered if there were tides in the lake. That would be terrifying in Christoph's position. "You're going to pay for this," yelled the Dutchman. "Defiant to the end. Good for you." "I'm going to kill you!" There was an edge of panic in his voice. I wondered if he had a phobia, Although, to be fair, I'd be a little freaked out stuck in the mud like that. As long as he wasn't sinking past his nose, I shifted my attention to the lake itself. I started running from the bridge and the half-buried killer to search for Natalie. But I hadn't forgotten about the other killer, Ollie. I sprinted as fast as I could away from the bridge. The bank proved to be slick and littered with boulders and drain pipes. This was not the place to run with no light at all shining on the ground. I skidded to a stop 50 yards away from the bridge. I thought I'd heard something. I balled my hands into fists in case I stumbled into Ollie. Then I heard it again. A faint cry and water splashing. I screamed, "Natalie!" I heard a response, I thought. And I just caught a glimpse of the water moving 20 yards offshore just ahead of me. I couldn't wait to ensure the other killer wasn't nearby. Natalie was in trouble. I dove in, shocked by how cold the water was. I knew that whatever I did, it had to be fast. If I'd known beforehand how cold the water was, I probably wouldn't have thrown Natalie into it. But at the time, I hadn't had a choice. I had a hard time distinguishing the splashing sounds I was making in the water from the sounds I heard. There was very little light on the lake, and I couldn't see anything past a few feet. I knew I sounded panicked when I yelled, "Natalie! Natalie!" on an almost unending loop. Then I saw something just break the surface of the water a few feet in front of me. I kicked hard in the water and closed the distance in a couple of seconds. There was nothing there. I frantically moved my hands under the water and felt something brush my leg. I ducked underwater and followed its path. My hand closed around something. It was a wrist. Oh my God, it was Natalie. I pulled with all my might, kicking my legs to counterbalance the force of pulling Natalie up. It felt like it took forever. It could have been wet cement I was pulling her through. Progress was so slow, it hurt me physically. Finally, I had her head above water. I waited for that first big gasp to suck in air. It didn't come. Her face was ice cold, and her eyes were closed. I had to get her to shore to give her CPR. It was her only chance. I swam hard with Natalie hooked under one arm. I hadn't done a water rescue since I was a patrolman and dove in for a kid who had fallen into the East River. When I brought him back to the seawall, there were a dozen people who helped us out of the water. That wasn't going to happen tonight. Chapter 91. We thrashed in the water as Natalie drifted in and out of consciousness. She'd wake up in panic, elbowing me and kicking wildly. Then she'd pass out and be dead weight. It was exhausting. Murky water splashed into my mouth, and I kept swallowing it. My legs and lungs started to burn as I swam. It took me a minute to realize that in the darkness, I hadn't gone in the right direction. I had been swimming parallel to the shore. Wasting precious energy wasn't something I could afford to do right now. Finally, I got my bearings. The tiny red light flashed in the distance and gave me a focal point. I kept heading toward the tiny light until my feet brushed the sandy bottom of the lake. I lifted Natalie out of the water as I trudged toward shore. It took longer than I had expected, but I pulled Natalie onto the shore and wasted no more time. I stripped off the wool sweater that had weighed her down. I fell right into the training I'd received over and over again from the NYPD. I shook her to make sure she wasn't responding. I checked her pulse, then cleared her mouth with my finger. There was nothing in her mouth, and she gave no reaction. Water rescues are no fun and dangerous, but CPR in a situation like this was positively terrifying. I pinched her nose with two fingers. Since she was ice cold, I wondered if some of her problems were related to hypothermia. I sealed my lips over hers and started my first rescue breath. It was longer and deeper than I intended. As I raised my head slightly to take in more air, I felt Natalie move. At least I think I did. Just as I was about to give another serious rescue breath, she coughed. Gurgled is more accurate. I had seen it a dozen times. I knew just what to do. Jump out of the way. She sat up quickly and turned to one side. Water cascaded out of her mouth as she coughed and vomited. She cleared her throat several times and coughed up more water. It felt like she'd been in the lake for hours, but maybe it'd been only minutes. As long as she was coughing, she was breathing. That was a win. I sat by her and put my hand on her shoulder. After almost a full minute, she turned and looked at me. Then she threw her arms around my neck and gave me a hug. When I wrapped my arms around her and patted her back, she started to sob. At first, I thought it was a reaction to the drowning. Then she said,
"How did I end up here? With men trying to kill me? Almost getting you killed?"
She just started crying again. I got it. I really did. I had experienced this with my own daughters. Maybe not in so dramatic a fashion, but I understood the release. Then, I remembered there was another killer out there. I let go of Natalie and stood up to scan the area. I could see the approach to the park because of the lights out on the street nearby. Just the lake and its banks were completely dark. Then I saw him. He was standing on a hill not far from the street. Ollie looked a little like the creature from the Black Lagoon the way he moved. He had apparently jumped into the lake at some point. His wet shirt, plastered to his wide chest, showed that he wasn't just a big lump of fat. He turned and faced me. It was pretty far for a pistol shot. I didn't know what I was going to do if he started shambling back toward us with that stiff-legged gait both the wet pants and the earlier car crash had given him. But he stayed right where he was. Then he did something to surprise me. Ollie gave me a casual salute. He called down to me in English.
"You're both too much trouble. As a professional, I have to know when to cut my losses. Good luck."
He turned quickly and disappeared across the street. Then I heard faint sirens. That's what had scared him off. I helped Natalie over to where Kristoff was stuck in the mud. He screamed,
"Dig me out of this! You're just trying to torture me! Get me out right now!"
I figured it was a job for a local fire rescue team. Natalie and Kristoff both looked like they'd just survived the worst day of their lives. I hoped this really was the worst day Natalie ever had. I knew Kristoff was going to have many that would be worse. Chapter 92. Natalie and I were checked for injuries at East Tallinn Central Hospital. There weren't a ton of hospitals in Estonia's capital, at least not by New York standards, and I was glad to find it was the same hospital where Bill Fiore was recovering from his gunshot wounds. I was anxious to see the crusty FBI man, but first I needed to make sure Natalie was okay. I sat on a hard plastic chair in the hallway outside an examination room. It was mid-morning. I'd been up more than 24 hours, and the bright lights of the hospital were brutal on my tired eyes. No one seemed to notice me. I wore surgical scrubs someone had given me and a pair of tennis shoes that were a size too tight. But I wasn't going to complain. I was alive. Natalie was alive. And we were both safe. All that was left now was the plane ride home. Somehow I'd resisted calling Mary Catherine once we were safe. It would have been the middle of the night in New York. She would be just as happy to hear about my success and return after a full night's sleep. I found the FBI agent's room on the fifth floor. None of the nurses gave me a second look. I guess it was the surgical scrubs that confused them. Or maybe they just didn't care as much in Estonia if you had extra visitors. There was an Estonian police officer sitting on a stool outside Fiore's room. Luckily, he had met me earlier when I shared everything I knew with him and another police officer. He motioned me into the room without any fanfare. I nodded to him. The police were clearly concerned about the security measures. Maybe Henry hadn't been pulling my chain when he told me what a badass he was. He hadn't yet been picked up, but I'd given the Estonian police and anyone else who would listen all I had on the cybercriminal. The cops had been impressed by the way I'd managed to stick the Dutch killer, Christoph, in the mud. Apparently there were John Doe warrants for him in the Netherlands, Belgium, and Latvia. New York would throw some more warrants in for him and his former partner, Ollie. It could have been a hospital room anywhere in the States. White, clinical, dull, with a TV anchored to the wall. The only thing that surprised me in the room was Father Marty Zlotic, sitting on the far side of the bed, chatting with the silent Bill Fiore. The FBI man was sitting up, with the bed elevated. He had tubes in his nose and two IVs in his right arm, with one of them bandaged into his hand. Fiore turned his head as I walked in. Father Marty let a huge smile spread across his face as he stood up to greet me. He came around the bed and embraced me. I felt Agent Fiore deserved some extra attention from me, especially after you told me how he saved your life. God surely guided him into our lives. It all worked out for the best, Father. You had us so worried last night. Sorry to cause you all this trouble, Father. The priest laughed. Trouble? This is the most interesting week I've had in years. I wouldn't trade this experience for anything, especially since you rescued the girl. I've been filling in Agent Fiore on everything. He is most impressed. I couldn't help but smile when I looked toward the FBI agent. No employee of the Federal Bureau of Investigation was ever going to admit he was impressed by the NYPD, especially in another country. Fiore motioned me over to his bed with a movement of his left hand. I came closer, but he couldn't speak clearly. He was weak and had too many tubes. He motioned me closer. I lowered my ear toward his mouth in case he wanted to speak. I knew it would be hard for him to admit I had done the right thing saving Natalie. I didn't intend to rub it in his face. Much. As I leaned over, he tried to form a word. At first, it was just air brushing over his vocal cords without much response. Finally, after great effort, he managed to make his word clear. I steadied myself on the bed, my head just above his mouth. Then he said, "Asshole." I started to guffaw. It was hard not to. A man who had risked his life, been shot twice, barely out of the operating room, and he still managed to summon enough strength to call me a name. I loved it. It completely restored my faith in the FBI. I wouldn't repeat to Father Marty what he'd said, even after the priest asked. I looked down, and Fiore managed to smile under the tubes. I said, "I agree with you. If someone had come into my jurisdiction and ignored every reasonable warning I gave them, I would have choice words as well." I patted the FBI man on his unbandaged shoulder. "Let me say it clearly in front of a witness. You saved my ass." I quickly looked up at the priest, ready to change ass to life. Father Marty motioned me to continue. "I'm going to tell you something I've never told an FBI agent." I liked the look of anticipation Fiore managed, even under these difficult circumstances. I sucked in a breath of air and said, "You are one hell of a cop." I meant it. Chapter 93. I'd never felt so safe preparing to board a flight in my life. Natalie and I were in a lounge at Lennart Meri Airport with several Estonian police officers and Bill Fiore's FBI partner, Matt Miller. The Estonian police were growing more concerned about how Henry's operation had flown under their radar for so long. The cops could have been from any country. Command staff in suits, detectives in cheap jackets, and a few patrol officers, years younger than the others. Lots of bald spots and graying hair, a phenomenon that happens to all police officers, regardless of nationality. Stress takes years off our lives. One of the less talked about aspects of police work, and one of the contributing factors to an early death after retirement. I knew how uncovering an operation like Henry's would lead to speculation about corruption,
and that sometimes affects an investigation, because no one is sure who to trust. Besides all the damage to the concrete columns, they'd found only a couple of casings and some blood in the warehouse room where the big shootout took place. I wasn't much help finding the second office. Natalie was able to point them to where it was located, but Henry and his crew had cleaned the place out by the time the cops showed up. As I sat in a comfortable, cushioned chair, I muttered, "This is a lot of protection." Matt Miller, who sat next to me, said, "There's no way the Estonians want to explain how a cyber criminal like Henry whacked you at the airport. They're going to cover you like Secret Service agents around the president." I smiled and checked my watch. It was 7 o'clock in the morning in New York, and I made the call I'd been avoiding. Telling your fiancé that you were almost killed is never fun. I figured I would gloss over a lot of the trip. As soon as I heard Mary Catherine's voice, any concerns I had vanished. All I wanted to do was get home. She had a million questions. She quickly spit out, "Are you okay? How can I help? What's Estonia like?" "I'm fine. Don't need anything. Estonia's nice." Before I could ask about the kids, she said, "Did you find the mayor's daughter?" "Yeah, she's coming home with me." Mary Catherine let out a squeal.
"When will you be home?"
"This evening." I gave her the flight information.
"Did you have any trouble? Was the mayor's daughter really in danger?"
I thought about saying we had a bad connection. Instead, I deferred answers until I got back. I spent about a minute talking with each kid. Everyone said they were looking forward to me coming home. So was I. At the first boarding call for the flight, Agent Miller gave me a quick rundown of what he knew. He said, "I was waiting to catch you up in case I heard something new. The Estonian authorities are chasing down a ton of leads." "They seem like they're squared away,"